are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
If you're a business owner who's hiring, you probably face a lot of challenges when it comes to finding the right person for your role, like not enough applicants with the right skills or experience, or too many resumes to sort through, yet you need to hire as soon as possible, or not knowing where to post your job to reach the right people. And that's why hiring can feel like trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, it gets sent to over 100 top job sites with one click. Then ZipRecruiter's matching technology finds people with the right skills and experience for your job and actively invites them to apply. In fact, ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. It's no wonder over 2.3 million businesses have come to ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. So while other companies overwhelm you with way too many options, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for, the needle in the haystack. Now you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. Once again, remember to go to this unique place, ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Good evening. The year is 1917, less than 2 decades into the new century, and already the Great War is occurring in the muddy fields of France. Soon there will be the Spanish influenza, which will kill many more millions. An inauspicious start to a new millennium, to be sure. In one of Canada's largest cities, Toronto, there has been a murder. A cab driver is found dead in West End Toronto, stabbed multiple times. The cabbie's name is Carmine Lapello, a.k.a. Tony Lapello, a.k.a. Tony Ross, an Italian-Canadian. Inquests occur, but the murderer is never found. Now we take a leap forward to the year 1964, when a 10-year-old Joe Lapello is going through some cardboard boxes in his parents' basement. He finds an old photo of a handsome young man. He takes the picture to his father and is told that the picture is of Joe's great-uncle, Carmine Lapello. Joe's father was only 7 years old at the time of the murder. Become entwined in a story of a young man's undying love for a woman, which would drive him to participate in illegal alcohol smuggling during the Prohibition era. Carmine was a self-employed taxi driver who became caught up with notorious people in a small immigrant community of Toronto, Ontario, Canada, known as The Ward. Circumstances would change for the worse, turning this young man from a secretive life of crime to that of a police informant and eventually paying the ultimate price. In the early morning hours of July 20th, 1917, Carmine would be found brutally murdered in the street. Follow Joseph Lapello through his discovery of this mystery as he unravels the unsolved murder of his great-uncle, Carmine Lapello. The book that we're featuring this evening is Murder, Lost to Time, the true story of one of Canada's oldest unsolved murders, with my special guest, author Joseph A. Lapello. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Joseph A. Lapello.
Thank you, Dan.
Hope I didn't mispronounce your name.
This morning.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. Now, as we just alluded to in the introduction, this was spring of 1964. You were asked to clean up the basement at your home. You found a small shoebox. You were 10 years old. Tell us what you found in that shoebox and what this represented in terms of your investigation into your uncle's murder.
Well, what I found in the shoebox was various photographs of aunts and uncles, people I all recognized. You know, I was 10 years old. We used to visit every Sunday or weekends over at their houses. But I found this one picture. I knew the picture was a little bit older, of a young man, and I had never seen him before. And like you said in the introduction, I showed it to my father, and he explained to me who he was and what had happened to him. And I found it very curious when I found out that he was murdered, that it had never been solved. I found that particularly interesting, you know. And that's my introduction into the case. It was at that age, 10 years old, and it was quite, you know, I mean, I shouldn't even have been looking. I was supposed to be cleaning up the shelf in the basement. And cleaning up the basement, and I had just, my curiosity, I was opening boxes and seeing what was in there, and his photograph was in there with a bunch of other photographs.
Mm-hmm. You write, too, that you said that it was, your dad said it was a murder meant for someone else, and I didn't really want to talk about this at all, but your mother said Carmine was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Now, you write about 10 years after finding this photo, you meet a person named Joseph Pill. Now, you're supposed to go to a bar with your friend, but you end up at a billiards room at Young and Dundas. And you're there about 30 minutes. So, man, how does Joseph Pill come you to meet? How do you come to meet Joseph Pill?
Well, I came to meet him, like, I was in the billiard hall with my friend. We had arrived downtown a little bit early, and to kill some time before we went to a bar, he suggested we go to a billiard room, play a couple of games, which we did do. We had been there a half an hour, 45 minutes, and I could see the entrance of the billiard hall from where the table we were playing on. An elderly man came in. He was in his late 70s, and I really didn't pay any attention to him. But slowly but surely, he had worked his way over to the way to the table that my friend and I were playing on, and he was staring at me. And I found this quite unusual. I didn't know this man. I couldn't recall him from anywhere. And my friend had made a remark. Jesus, Joe, you know, it looks like the old guy likes you. And laughing at it and everything. It was obvious he was staring at me, wanted to speak to me, but, you know, maybe he was a little bit shy or intimidated, you know, 20-year-old kid. How was I going to react to him saying something to me? So I said hello to him. And he introduced himself as Joseph Pill, and that he was. And he asked me what my name was. He says, "Is your name LaPello?" And I was shocked that he knew my name, because I didn't know him. I said, "Yes, it is." And he says, "I knew your." He said, "My uncle." Well, is in fact, Carmine was my great uncle. And
right.
He said, "I knew him. I grew up with him. We were school chums from a very early age, from about when they were 6 years old or something. And they didn't live too far away, and they went to the same school." He said that he was a taxi driver, and he was with my uncle. The night that the murder happened, he was on a taxi stand in Toronto. They had both their cars parked there waiting for fares. And at the time, I didn't have any preliminary knowledge on the case, so I didn't know what questions to ask him about my great-uncle, except maybe his personality, what had happened. And the recurring response I kept getting from Joseph Pill was they never found out who did it. They never found out. They never caught the people that did it. And he seemed very upset about that, like very personally upset about it. You know, he was close to Carmine and everything. And I often got the feeling when I look back at that meeting between him and I, that was the only person I ever spoke to who was alive about the knowing my great uncle or anything, that he had carried some guilt about it, you know, some remorse about maybe the way he behaved or did back then concerning the whole murder. So that was one meeting I had with him, and I never saw him again. I had went down to that billiard room because he said he lived in the area downtown. He lived there all his life, and that he comes into the billiard room frequently. I didn't get a phone number or anything from him. I just thought I'd see him again. I never did. But he was an eyewitness to the events that happened on the taxi stand that night.
Mm-hmm. You didn't know what the importance was, and you felt at that time, you write, that there was just something more he wanted to say, and there was certainly, as you just said, there was a certain amount of regret, it seemed, but you didn't know anything about the case really at that time. So you didn't have any reference for what he was saying, any context for what he was saying at that time. And, of course, you never got to speak to him again or see him. Your mother passes away in 2005, so you had to go through these through boxes of mementos. What do you find in 2005?
I find Carmine's picture again in the same shoebox that I had found it in 1964. When I was 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it just, you know, it rekindled some memories of when I was 10 years old, speaking to my parents about it. When I was 20 years old, and I met Joseph Pill. And in between, the time I met Joseph Pill was 1974, and in between 2005, I mean, it came to mind, the case came to mind a few times, but I was, you know, preoccupied with my own life, you know, and didn't really have any time to spend on it, delving into the case and doing more research on it.
Right. You write that you took another 5 years after this, 2010, you were more ready to delve into this mystery. Of course, you realized Joseph Pill would be dead by that time. How did you start your investigation? Where did it start? And what did you find?
The first thing I did was I Googled his name into my computer, Carmine's name, the victim. And there was a website in Canada for murdered taxi drivers. And sure enough, his name was the first one on the list in 1917. And it gave a brief outline into the case, and it detailed the date it happened, the time where the body was found, and everything. But at the end of the article, it also said that some guilt or blame for the murder was placed on a man, a sailor in Britain, who had lived in Canada at the time. It didn't mention his name or anything like that, but I thought that in 1923, he was convicted of murdering a taxi driver in London, England, and the newspaper here, he was sentenced to death, but his death sentence was later commuted by an act of parliament based on the flimsy evidence that convicted him, very shaky evidence. It was. I don't think he was guilty at all, but the newspaper here picked up on it, the Toronto Star, I think, and sort of laid the blame for my great uncle's murder on him, you know. And then, so I researched him as well as I could and found, and I had to eliminate him as a suspect. He just did not fit the profile of somebody that would be involved in a heinous murder like this.
You found out that your uncle, great uncle, was owner of two cars, one driven by another employee. What did you find out about the registration for those cars, however? Before we talk about the actual, what you find out about Friday, July 19th, the day before, July 19th, just before midnight, 11:30, and with fellow taxi driver Joseph Pill sitting in Carmine's car. Tell us a little bit about just what you found about the ownership of these cars before we talk about July 19th, 11:30, at the taxi driver stand with Joseph Pill.
Okay. Well, it had been said in the newspaper in a few articles that Carmine was the owner of these two cars, but the cars were actually registered in another man's name, a man, Edgar Bridges, I think. Edgar Bridges. And the cars were registered in his name. But I thought that very odd. Like, why would Carmine be the owner of two taxis and have them in somebody else's name? At first, it made no sense to me, but later on, I found out the reason for that. And it became very questionable to me whether or not Carmine was the real owner of these cars, because 1 year prior to supposedly going into the taxi business, the price of those two taxi cabs at the time might have been between $1,200 and $2,000. I knew Carmine's parents were immigrants. They were laborers. They didn't have that type of money to be to lend to Carmine so he could buy these cars. So I began to question, well, where did he get this money to buy these cars? And were they even his cars? I came to believe and conclude that they were not his cars. He said he was the owner. He had business cards written up with the number of his taxi cabs in case anybody wanted to call the dispatch to have him pick up a fare. But, I mean, the only assets in the taxi business are the cars. Why would you put them in somebody else's name? The only reason to do that is if you were up to something illegal with them. And in the event you were caught, the real owner of the car would be able to come to court and say, well, you know, they're my cars and they're my taxis, and he was just working for me and I had no idea what he was doing. And then the court would have to release those cars back to the original owner because they wouldn't be able to prove that he had knowledge that they were being used for an illegal purpose. That's the only thing I could conclude by that. But, prior to 1916, 1 year before that, he was borrowing money from his estranged wife, Carmine.
Yeah.
And I don't think he had paid it back. So if he was borrowing, and it was a very small amount by today's standards, only $50 or $100, but back then that was a lot of money. If he couldn't pay back, where was he getting the money? A couple of $1,000 to buy these two cars and to go into business. It just didn't make sense. It didn't add up to me, Dan.
Yeah, you were getting a better, clearer picture of what was going on with your great uncle and the business he was undertaking. Let's, as you describe for us, walk us through that night, 11:30, July 19th, close to midnight, 1917. Joseph Pill is sitting in Carmine's car at Toronto Street near King Edward Hotel, what was today King Edward Hotel. Tell us about what Joseph Pill says, especially initially, about who he sees and what these people, this man and woman, do that night.
Okay, well, the man and woman approached the taxi stand from the east, walking along King Street. And right at the corner of King and Toronto Street is a taxi stand. As a matter of fact, there's still a taxi stand there over 100 years later. And as they approached, the woman went to the driver's side of the car, where Carmine was sitting, because Joseph Pill and him were sitting in Carmine's car, and Joseph Pill's car was behind. And the man who came with this woman went to the back of the taxi cab, and he acted very, very suspicious insofar as he didn't do any of the talking to try and hire Carmine. And he had he was wearing a cap which was pulled over his face, and had the collar of his jacket was pulled up to conceal his identity. And he never spoke a word all the time he was there. The woman did all the talking, and she said, "I want to go out to Hyde Park in the green car with the white stripe. I was out that way 2 or 3 days ago." And that's the car the me out there. Well, Carmine's car was green and it had a white stripe on it. And Carmine said to her that you must have been out with my driver because, you know, I don't remember taking you. And at first, Carmine did not want to take them. And Joseph Pill didn't want to take them either. For some reason, they were alarmed by this couple. You know, they were very shabbily dressed. They didn't look like they had the money for the taxi fare. Mm-hmm. And Carmine and Joseph Pill, the man I met in the billiard room in downtown Toronto, argued about this for 15 or 20 minutes till finally Carmine said, oh, that's fine, I'll take them. And at the precise moment that he was loading them into his car, another driver pulled up to the stand and offered to take them to their location, their destination out in the High Park, and or the High Park area. And the man who accompanied the woman, who was asking for to hire a taxi cab, waved off the other driver and pointed to Carmine's car. Then they both got in, and Carmine drove away, which it was very shortly after midnight. It could have been, you know, 12, 15 or something like that. And that's the last time Joseph Pill ever saw my great-uncle alive.
Mm-hmm. Now, you write that the next day, around 5:15 a.m. or so, this is July 20th, a workman finds Carmine's body on Salisbury Avenue, 50 yards north of Queen Street area, in the Humber Bay area, on the western outskirts of Toronto. His car parked about 25 feet from the body. He is stabbed 14 times in the back. Police believe it's from a stiletto knife. When his body's found, he is still warm, and so they estimate that he was dead maybe only an hour and a half at that time. Witnesses heard two men arguing earlier that morning. They thought it was sounded Italian, and they had heard a scuffle and a car speed away around 4 a.m. or so. Now, once you found that information, you write that this little photo you had of your great uncle, you wouldn't need that on your computer anymore. You didn't need a reminder to deep dive into this investigation and find out who killed your great uncle. Isn't that true?
Yes, it is. The facts that you've laid out there made me conclude a couple of things. The witness you're talking about was a man named George Rush Sr. He lived at 58 Salisbury on the same street where the murder took place. He had been called out at 3 a.m. to get a car out of a ditch. He went out, got the car out of the ditch. He returned back to his home at 4 o'clock. At that time, approximately 60 yards away from his house, it was very dark, by the way, back then. There were no street lights or anything. He had seen the figures of two people. One man was quite a bit taller than the other one, and he heard them arguing in a foreign language. He was asked at a coroner's inquest if it was Italian. Well, George Rush didn't speak Italian. He couldn't say for sure. He couldn't confirm it. But Carmine could only speak English and Italian. And so we have to conclude that the argument was in Italian, which meant that the killer, the man he was fighting with then, and the fight that George Rush witnessed, was with another Italian. But another observation George Rush made was that one man was quite a bit taller than the other. Now, the man from the taxi stand who accompanied the woman who hired Carmine was approximately 5'6". The autopsy report puts Carmine's height at 5'7". Well, at 60 yards, a one-inch difference in height wouldn't be that noticeable.
Right.
So I started to ask myself, you know, the man who was with the woman from the taxi stand, he couldn't have committed the murder because there was an eyewitness and a discrepancy in the height that was very distinguishable. And so I knew then that this was a conspiracy. I knew that the primary job of the man and woman who originally hired him at the taxi stand, their job was to lure him out to that area. And once they got him there, at that time I didn't know what they do. I later found out that they left him. I believe they were at a location there, and then the killer was brought out there and driven out there by somebody else. Once the man and woman left Carmine, the killer posed as a taxi fare wanting to go back to Toronto, so Carmine naturally picked him up and agreed to take him. And when they stopped on Salisbury Avenue, that's when the fight started. After the fight, there were not just George Rush. He saw the fight and went into the house. But there were two women who lived on Queen Street, very close to that location, that heard a car speeding along Queen Street going west. It stopped. It turned around. It was there for a little while. And then later off, it sped back to Toronto. Well, obviously, the man who murdered Carmine had a getaway driver. Once he finished committing the murder, he ran down to Queen Street. He was picked up, and then they both headed back to Toronto. So, does that answer your question, Dan? I didn't need any reminder of the case. I didn't need the picture in front of me anymore because it began to intrigue me as a real mystery. And what was unfolding in front of me was the makings of a plot, like a conspiracy, of a plan. This wasn't, the police originally and right to the end of their investigation seized on the motive of sudden jealousy, as if my great uncle had offended this woman, and the man went into a rage. They had a fight, and the man killed him. Like sudden jealousy, a crime of passion. But later facts that I uncovered just tore that theory all apart.
You talk about what police were led to believe, and we'll talk about that in a while, how they were led to believe and by who, that misled by this person and misled the police with this kind of idea that it was jealous rage. Now, why it also police felt that is because you say that Carmine's body was staged. Tell us how it was staged to look to accommodate this narrative that police later believed was true, thanks to the guidance of the woman, the mysterious woman in this case.
Well, when the body was originally found, it was he was laying on his back. It was discovered later he had been stabbed 14 times, which sent up a bit of a red flag to me. If this was a case of, I was considering everything, even like a robbery. Okay, but I had to discount the robbery theory because nothing had been taken from his body. He had, he had a gold hunter's watch. He had $5, which doesn't sound like much now, but back then it represented, a half a week's pay or $6, a bank account. He had a ruby ring. These things were still all present, so I ruled out robbery. And his body was left with the pants pulled down and his privates exposed.
Yeah.
And I don't know if any of your listeners are Italian, but an Italian tradition of revenge against a man who has either insulted your wife or has done something to her to insult you, this is a very typical way to leave the body of the person who's done that if you've killed them. It's like to leave them in a state of eternal disgrace.
Sure.
For offending your woman. Okay? So, but the police would have known that back then, because there was organized crime in Toronto. They had a bit of a glimpse into it, and they would know that this would be the result of a man who went crazy because you insulted his woman or made a pass at her in front of him, and the amount of stab wounds too. It seemed like an overkill. You know, it was like it was deliberately done to make it look like yes, somebody was in a jealous rage, uncontrollable jealous rage. Where in fact, the coroner found out after the second stab wound, which had punctured his lungs, he had already died. He was deceased. So every stab wound administered after the second or third was useless.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and leaving his body with the pants pulled down, his privates hanging out, he had disrespected a man's wife. That was the motive. That's what it looked like originally at the scene, and that's the motive they seized on, because they had no other motive.
You write, though, that you found, right on this, the very first thing that you found online, the taxi driver site, that Carmine had received an unsigned letter in February 1917 threatening his life. What was in that letter? Why were they threatening his life? What were they telling him not to do anymore?
Well, what the letter was sent to his estranged wife, threatening his life and telling him to stop talking to the police. The letter didn't describe what he was talking to the police about. It just told him, stop talking to the police or, you're going to be killed.
Right. Now,
Well, it seemed to me that if in February of 1917 he received this letter telling him to stop talking to the police, and in July he ends up dead, obviously he's still talking to the police, or they, who's ever killed him, believes he is. And that's
right.
The real motive. You know, it's not a case of sudden jealousy the way the crime scene was staged, you know.
Sure. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, we're at the point where in your investigation you find what you find is, you believe is the real motive, and you're finding now, you're putting together the plot that occurred here, this what had happened and who was involved. And it's fascinating in this investigation that you undertook, basically an amateur sleuth, some of the things that you used to your advantage, some of the resources. You talked about this inspector from the of Ontario Provincial Police, the equivalent of state police in Canada, this Inspector Boyd. And so you read his report and got a lot of information. You read this taxi driver site, and then you went to Ancestry and did some interesting work to connect the dots. Tell us about some of the things, including with newspaper archives, how you came to find out who you believe are the suspects, were the perpetrators of this crime, this whole group that conspired to kill your uncle, and why.
Okay, well, I guess I should explain first that the problem with this case was not only its age, and there was nobody to speak to about it, but because I was an amateur, didn't know anything about this and how to go about it, I kept running out of sources of research. Once I had all the newspaper articles, I made a Freedom of Information request to try and get the police report from the Ontario Provincial Police, Inspector Boyd, who was, and there was actually three police forces working on this. There was Toronto Police, the Mimico Police, and the OPP.
Mm-hmm.
But Inspector Boyd was put in charge of the case. Now, in his report, there was a few things that I found that weren't in any of the newspaper articles, but nothing in his report conclusively identified the man and woman. They were still a mystery. And that's later on I had to broaden my search to find out who they were. But I got names from that report. And there was one report as he was interviewing people at a location in Toronto's area known as the Ward. It was St. John's Ward on a street called Elm. And I found that there was a boarding house, grocery store, and residence there. And it was a bit of a notorious place. Most of the lodgers were very transient. Now, like, they would stay there a week or two and they would leave. But a conversation had taken place there. And this was reported to Inspector Boyd by somebody who was actually informing to him about the murder. And two of the lodgers were talking, and one of them said, you know, they were talking about the murder, and he had heard that somebody was arrested. And the other one said, well, how can that be? The person who did it was just here a little while ago. This was on a Sunday afternoon. And those two lodgers had an argument, and the next day they left that lodging house, and nobody knew their names. They were never identified. But there was also a man wanted in Hamilton. The police, he was a wanted man from Hamilton, Ontario, which is about 30 miles away from Toronto, and he was hidden out there. So it made this location and the people running it very suspicious to me. And I broadened my search on them, found out as much as I could about them, which it gave me a lot of information that helped me find the information of the people who planned this and who committed this murder later on. There was a private from the Canadian Army. His name was Arthur Colin Kilner. And nine mm-hmm. days after the murder, he was on a train coming from Montreal. He was on leave, so he went to Montreal to visit his mother. On his way back to Toronto to rejoin his regiment, he was approached by a woman on a train who, by the way, matched the description of the woman from the taxi stand the night of the murder. And she started a conversation with him and asked him where he was going and everything. And he told her, you know, he was heading back to Toronto, and she asked him if he would pick up her suitcase for her down in Toronto. She had left it there, and when he asked why she didn't pick it up herself, why she just didn't go and pick it up herself, she explained to this young private from the Canadian Army that approximately 9 days earlier, her and her husband were out in a taxi cab around the Humber Bay area, and the taxi cab driver and her husband got into an argument. She left, and the next day, she doesn't know what she's explained to him. She didn't know what happened. But the next day, the taxi driver was found murdered, and she didn't want to, you know, go back to the location where her suitcase was. He agreed to pick up her suitcase. They had a drink, a cup of coffee or something, which he bought. And shortly after taking this drink, having this drink of coffee with her, the private got got violently ill to his stomach. He went into a cold sweat. He was vomiting. He was so sick that when the train stopped halfway between Montreal and Toronto at a town called Belleville, he had to be removed and hospitalized. He was in the hospital for 9 or 10 days before Inspector Boyd, who was in charge of the case, was notified. And he went to see this private, and sure enough, the description of the private gave Inspector Boyd of this woman matched up with the woman from the taxi stand. The woman had also mentioned that she was from Montreal, and she would only be in Toronto a couple of days. She actually went to the effort of showing Private Kilner her return train ticket back to Montreal. So for all intents and purposes, everybody thought she was from Montreal. Well, sure enough, Inspector Boyd secures leave from the Canadian Army to take Private Kilner to Montreal and look for this woman. But I mean, obviously, this was just another act of deception. Because what had happened, before all this took place, Inspector Boyd had been at 124 Elm Street, this residence where there was a grocery store, a hideout for criminals, a lodging house, and it was in the middle of the ward, which was riddled with crime at the time, and the crime was all around down there. He had questioned the people that owned this grocery store, lodging house, and residence about the murder. I believe that the man and woman from the taxi stand had made their way up to Northern Ontario. From there, they separated. The man came back to Toronto, and the woman went on to Montreal, where she was hiding out. After Inspector Boyd went to the ward, to this address at 124 Elm Street, questioned these people, I believe these people got frightened, because they did know the murder. They mm-hmm. didn't know the murderer. And their grocery store, they had a truck that used to go out to the area where the murder was committed, because there was hobby farms out there. And that's where they used to buy their vegetables and fruit and bring it back to their grocery store and sell it.
Right.
Well, the two women on Queen Street that witnessed the car speeding by, the getaway driver, I think the getaway driver... the lights were on in their house, and I think the getaway driver saw them, and he thought that they saw him and the killer driving back to Toronto. So when
right.
they got back to Toronto, they told this woman who owned the truck and the grocery store, which they had used her truck as the getaway vehicle, if anyone asks, were you out that way near the murder scene, you tell them you were out there buying vegetables. When the police questioned Mrs. Colello from 124 Elm Street, she said, yes, I was out there buying vegetables. I saw the car and the body, but I thought it was somebody sleeping off a drunk. Well, I thought that very suspicious. Why would somebody... Carmine's body was found in a ditch. Why would somebody sleep a drunk off in a ditch when they had the back of the car to sleep in?
Sure.
So I knew she was yeah. lying right away. So this became a very suspicious address to me in Toronto.
You continued, too, as well, with a report that you pieced together that there was a witness that said something about a car leaving 124 Elm Street the night of the murder.
Yeah, that was in Inspector Boyd's report, but he doesn't say mm-hmm. who said that.
Right.
So I don't know who actually said that, but it's in his report that somebody said to him that a car was left, that left that address in the ward, 124 Elm Street, at 3 a.m. in the morning. And in the car was a man who was wanted for stabbing. But his
An
name
Italian.
Wasn't mentioned either.
Mm-hmm.
So... because there were no names mentioned, either of the driver or the passenger who was wanted for stabbing, the only benefit that was to me was the timeline. At 3 a.m., that car was seen leaving the ward in Toronto. Well, that gave them plenty of time to get out to the Humber Bay area, get situated,
right.
you know, and wherever Carmine... I believe Carmine was being babysitted by the man and woman from the taxi stand. They might have been out at a roadhouse or a all-night restaurant, something, or they might have been somewhere. Well, they were together, and once they left, this man came in and posed as the murderer came in and posed and as a taxi fare.
Right.
But the timeline was the thing that made me very suspicious. It fit perfectly. At 3 o'clock, they left the ward. At 4 o'clock, the murder occurred. It wouldn't have taken them a half an hour to get out to the Humber Bay area. Go to where Carmine was being babysitted, and then the murderer would, pose as a fare, commit the murder. And he'd be out there with his getaway driver, and then they'd be back in Toronto before 5 a.m. Before the body was found, they were probably back in Toronto. And the man and woman from the taxi stand were long on their way. body was discovered. As a matter of fact, they were seen at an area around 4:30 in Toronto that was near a train station, the Grand Trunk Railroad Station. From there, they could have caught a train to Northern Ontario. I checked with the records department of the train company, and yes, there was a train that left there at the Parkdale Station and went up to North Bay, where they were seen the next day by an insurance agent, a man named Winters, who had an insurance company up there. After he read the newspaper, he had a very sleepless night because the man and woman that he met up there that asked him for a ride to an area out there called Trout Lake up in northern Ontario, that their identities tallied up so exactly with that of the newspaper that he phoned the Crown Attorney, which in the United States you'd call it the District Attorney, to tell him, because there was already a reward put out for $500 for any information leading to the killers. So he, the report of Inspector Boyd was very useful to me because it had brought to the surface a lot of details that weren't in the newspaper, that the newspaper wasn't even privy to. Like this attack on the Canadian soldier appeared in no newspaper.
Interesting.
But it was in the police report. I should mention, too, that Joseph Pill, 3 days after the murder, got a threatening note to his house. So they knew where he lived and told him, you better stop helping the police, because his original statement to the police the day after the murder was that he saw this woman before in the ward. He didn't know the man. He didn't really get a good look at him. But if he saw this woman again, he would recognize her.
Right.
And shortly after getting the threatening letter at his house, all of a sudden his story started changing. Well, I don't know if I saw her before. I don't know if I could recognize her. I'm not sure now if it was the same woman I'm thinking of. So
now the reason.
Go ahead, Dan. Sorry.
Now the reason for his trepidation to get a threat like that. Joseph Pill was there the night his friend was taken away, abducted, murdered. And then he gets a warning that he shouldn't talk to police either, so he changes his story. But when you went through Ancestry, Ancestry.ca, you made some connections with organized crime, and you took it all the way back to, again, Italy, in the Calabria area of Italy, and you found out, took some of these names and did further research into their families and their criminal career. So you, and one of those people you researched heavily was Frank Lombardi. Tell us the Frank Lombardi 2 months before his interaction with Carmine, and then what you found out about Frank Lombardi.
Yeah, Frank Lombardi, he was a taxi driver. And he also lived in the ward. Actually, he was a neighbor of the people that the Colellos that lived at 124 Elm Street. He lived at 130 Elm Street,
mm-hmm.
And they knew each other. The families knew each other, and he was a taxi driver. He had come to Canada at a very early age, Frank Lombardi. He was educated here. He could speak English very well. And he, Carmine and him had, in May of 1917, had an argument, a pretty bad argument. And Frank Lombardi said at a coroner's inquest that the argument was over a dispute over a taxi fare. That Frank Lombardi thought it was his fare, and Carmine thought it was his. The fare belonged to him, and supposedly this is what this bad argument was about.
Right.
But I had spent day down at the archives of Toronto, and I got the police records book from 1916 and 1917, and I spent the whole day reading there. I didn't even know what I was looking for. I was just trying to find something that would I could see as recognizable that might give me another lead on what was going on. Well, I read through quite a few pages that day, and I came upon my great uncle's name. He had been charged with the illegal shipping of alcohol. Now, I didn't know what that charge was at the time, but he had been charged.
Right.
And Frank Lombardi, very close to the date that Carmine was charged, he was charged with the same thing. So obviously we were in the same business. And the argument over the fare was, wasn't true at all. What they were arguing was over. I believe that... I also found out that Carmine had been arrested a second time for the same charge. I believe it was then that either through coercion through the police or he made his own decision, he became an informer for the police. I think Frank Lombardi knew this. And this is what the argument was over. That is what the letter was all about in February, sent to Carmine from Montreal. Stop talking to the police or else. Well, Carmine, I don't think, realized the seriousness of the people he was dealing with.
Mm.
And he probably kept informing on them. And, you know, like you said at the introduction, he ended up paying the ultimate price for his bad decision, you know. But Frank Lombardi, he had been involved in shady dealings, illegal activities. The only thing is, it was mostly theft and things like that. I've got his criminal record going back to, I believe, 1898. The one thing that's absent from his early criminal record is any violence. He was just a man, I believe he dealt in stolen goods, and later on in our discussion we'll talk about what else he was involved in. And he had ties to organized crime. I don't know if he was an actual member or an associate. At 93 years after the murder and everybody being gone, it's hard to determine that for sure. But he sure knew everybody.
Let's talk about Rocco Perry and his wife Bessie.
Okay, well, Rocco Perry was an immigrant from Calabria, Italy, and he had originally landed in, I believe, Ellis Island, New York, made his way to Canada, to Montreal. From Montreal, he came to Toronto, and he was a laborer, and he was a boarder at the Tobin House. Bessie, when she was married, she was married to a man named Harry Tobin, and at their house they had some boarders. Rocco was one of them. Well, in 1911, Bessie and Rocco began an affair together.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after the affair, wait a minute now, in 1912, Rocco was charged in a small town, Guelph, just west of Toronto, about 50 miles west of Toronto, of murder. So he was in jail for a year awaiting trial. By the way, he got off on that charge. And he went back, got Bessie. Bessie had two small children. She abandoned them and her husband and ran off with Rocco. And Rocco was worked on the Welland Canal out by the Niagara region. It was just being built. It was a big project. And he was a laborer. But after that, he had murdered a guy he had actually murdered somebody who had disrespected a mob boss out in Guelph.
Right.
And the mob boss's wife was a relative to a man who was married to a daughter of the Colellos of 124 Elm Street. So this is how I started to piece together the family connection and the, organized crime family connection between all these people.
it was instrumental. We haven't mentioned too the Black Hand. Most people listening to this program will be familiar with its reputation and its history, but also you talk about some of that tradition coming to Canada and these guys employing that as well and being involved with Black Hand and also working on the common goal of bootlegging. And a unique situation where in Canada, the manufacturing of alcohol was legal. However, it was able for these criminal organizations, along with the legit manufacturers of alcohol, to be able to export that alcohol to the U.S., which would be incredibly lucrative. And also, as you say, the springboard for all the murder and mayhem and crime that ensued after that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, in the United States, Prohibition, the Volstead Act, was passed in 1920. But in Canada, our prohibition, alcohol prohibition, was passed in 1916. Now, this made the sale, the commercial sale, or the consumption of alcohol illegal, except one's own cellar stock. Like if you made enough wine to drink at dinner for yourself, which there was a limit
sure.
to how much you could have in your basement. You know,
mm-hmm.
maybe
sure.
10 bottles of wine, 20 bottles of wine to last a year.
Sure.
It didn't. Now the Volstead Act in the United States made the manufacture of alcohol illegal. In Canada, it wasn't illegal to manufacture it. Well, it was illegal to sell it here. If you manufactured it and exported it, you could brew as much alcohol, beer and alcohol as you wanted, as long as it got shipped offshore. So with the organized crime people found out that there was a flaw in this law the way it was written in Canada. Now,
sure.
What they did is they placed orders with breweries, say somebody that manufactured whiskey. They would have a phone call come from, say, New York State, and they would place an order for, say, 1,000 cases of whiskey to be delivered to somewhere in New York, upper New York State. Okay, so the manufacturer would manufacture them. He would sell it to the bootleggers. The bootleggers, when they got it to the dock, there would be a government official there, and they had to pay an excise tax. Okay, because for shipping it offshore, and all they had to do was load it on a boat, say that show the waybill that it was going to New York State. They would pay a certain amount of tax. Now, when the boat returned empty, they would recapture some of that tax. They were entitled to get some of their tax money back. But if nobody came back, or if they didn't come back and claim a portion of that tax they had already paid, well, the government just kept all the money. So the government was happy. They didn't care. They didn't have to refund any of this tax money. They were keeping it for themselves. It was additional revenue. So the flaw is, you could load up the same boat three times for export and say it was going to Cuba. It could come back three times the same day. As long as you paid the excise tax, the government didn't care what you did with it. They did. Yeah, later on in 1920, even though the Canadian government knew that alcohol was prohibited in the United States, as long as, you could put down in 1921 that it was being shipped to Upper New York State, the Canadian government didn't care as long as they got their tax for it. Once it
sure.
hit the shores of Upper New York State, it was the U.S.'s problem, U.S. authorities' problem. Canadian government didn't care. So that was a loophole in the law that they discovered. So you could manufacture, you couldn't be arrested for manufacturing beer here in Canada or whiskey as long as there was an order placed from another country to where it was going to be shipped.
Sure.
The order was placed from an, country. You know, calls come from New York State. That's another country. Even though alcohol was prohibited, it didn't matter to the Canadian government. That's where it was mm-hmm. going. You paid the tax to ship it. They kept the money. Everybody was happy. So they, sure. You know, like the way bill that, would say, oh, it's being shipped to Cuba. So they'd load it up in Toronto, wherever these breweries were, and they'd drive the boat over to Niagara Falls and unload it. And, yeah. and from there, they would distribute it to all the speakeasies in Ontario. Mm-hmm. That was the loophole that they found, and they took advantage mm-hmm. of it.
Right. Now, let's get back to the plot. You discover in this all the players, their connection to organized crime, and mysteriously, or not so mysteriously, you find out the 124 Elm Street connection. We've talked about that. Looks like the person involved, one of the people involved, left that, was driven away from that address towards where your uncle was killed. Give us what you found in total in terms of the plot to kill your uncle. Who were those players? Finally, you come to a resolution and a conclusion of who did what and who were the players. Tell us about that.
Okay. From the address 124 Elm Street, I was able, and through Frank Lombardi, through Frank Lombardi's family, I was able to find out this man, Rocco Perry. Now, I had heard this name before. I could only, the best way to describe him is, do you know what Al Capone was to Prohibition in the 20s mm-hmm. in Chicago, in the United States?
Yeah.
That's who Rocco Perry was to Canada.
Right.
He was the biggest bootlegger in Canada. Him and his gang, well, they were actually suspects in 17 unsolved homicides.
Mm-hmm.
And but the real brains behind Rocco's organization wasn't Rocco. The real brains was his common-law wife, the woman he had eloped with, Bessie Perry, or mm-hmm. Bessie Starkman was her maiden name. Her married name was Bessie Tobin, but she went by the name of Bessie Perry. She was an extremely smart woman. It was actually unfortunate she was born when she was, because had she have been born in the 21st century, it is no doubt in my mind that she would have been the CEO or CFO of a transnational conglomerate corporation. She was very smart. She educated herself, and she was cunning too. She was a very forward, strategic thinker. She was also a bit of a sociopath, and you can see that in her life. The way when she abandoned her two children, they were infants. One of them was like 8 months old, and the other one was a year and a half old. They were just babies, and she just left them to go run off with Rocco. And Rocco, at the time that they ran off, wasn't king of the bootleggers that he was, five years later. Everything that she did, she was convicted in Hamilton of running a brothel. And they were selling alcohol out of there in, 1918 or something like that. She was a person that she looked at everybody as if, what is it I can get from you? What is it you can do for me? And she was the brains behind. She did all the organizing. She did all the ordering. She arranged the shipping. Rocco and his crew were more or less the muscle. And but as far as their part in the murder, when this murder occurred, they weren't the prominent bootleggers that they had that they wound up being in the 1920s. But they were ruthless. If somebody stood in their way, there would be no hesitation hesitation to take that person out. You know, I'm not sure, Dan, as far as the Oregon, I mean, Rocco had ties all over southern Ontario in organized crime groups. As a matter of fact, the Purple Gang of Detroit, who were buying Canadian whiskey and selling it to Capone in Chicago, they were buying that whiskey off Rocco Perry. You know, so he was well embedded in that, in the illegal alcohol business, tying all these people up. To go into it in great detail, Dan, would be kind of tough because there's so, you know, there's cousins and then there's uncles and it's a family thing, you know, this organized crime group, you know. They stay to themselves. And what I basically found out is the man that Rocco killed in 1912, who had insulted the mob boss from Guelph, his wife, the mob boss's wife, was the sister of a man who was married to somebody at 124 Elm Street. There was the connection. That all led to Rocco Perry. Rocco Perry was a witness at the wedding, along of this man's wedding in 1919.
Mm-hmm.
And the other witness, the maid of honor, also was Mary Colello, who was a resident at 124 Elm Street. This was a very tight-knit group of people, ethnic Italian people. And the traditions from the old country, they just brought over here, the organized crime traditions. But it was really alcohol prohibition that gave them their big boost, gave them a chance to make tons of money, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that answers your question, Dan, did it? Or...
Well, the thing is, we talked about the role of Rossi and Bessie, but we have, again, is Bessie the person that went to that taxi stand?
Was she the woman?
And Rossi?
She is.
Yeah. So you have Rossi and you have Bessie.
Rocco.
Rocco's vested interest in this business, and your great uncle standing in the way, they believe. But you find out who actually, you believe, actually did the actual killing, this Berardelli.
Yes, it was a man named Giuseppe Bernardelli, but he went by the AKA Joe Berlito. He was a chef at the Queen's Hotel, which was one of the biggest hotels in Canada, and it was in Toronto. And he came under suspicion a few times in his life for being extremely violent. And he was also from the ward, and he worked for Rocco. Well, actually, he used to buy scotch and whiskey off Rocco, and he for wholesale, and he used to sell it retail. But he did work for Rocco, too. He was like an enforcer type of a guy. And you know, like Rocco had that area of the ward and surrounding area. He was the supplier to all the alcohol. If he ran into any trouble with somebody trying to come into his area, he would send, like, Giuseppe Bernardelli to see the people and straighten it out. And actually, Giuseppe Bernardelli, he got into a confrontation with Frank Lombardi in 1919, September of 1919. And Frank murdered him. He shot him. And at the coroner's inquest, you know, it came out that, you know, this Joe Berlito, Giuseppe Bernardelli, he was a, you know, he was a pimp. He sold alcohol. He used to muscle people down there in the ward for money. And he was connected to Rocco Perry. He fit the profile, and he was about 6'1 in height.
Yeah.
6'1, and he spoke Italian, exactly like the man at the murder scene, who had a fight with my, who was fighting with my great uncle, the man that George Rush, when he returned to his house, saw and heard. You know.
Yeah. It's fascinating too. You track down who you believe is the getaway driver, Charles Calarco.
Calarco.
And,
yeah.
And again, the connection to Elm Street.
Well, he was married to Annie Colello from 124
right.
Elm Street. And yeah. Annie Colello was the daughter of the people that owned 124 Elm Street, the grocery store. They were actually selling alcohol out of there, too, after 1916, supplied to by whom? By Rocco Perry, you know?
Yeah.
And where the man who was wanted in Guelph was kept in hiding, you know? So these people all connected up.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, you write of her fate, Bessie's fate with Rocco. Many years later, they go on to be very, very successful. They buy a 19-room mansion. They become very successful in bootlegging. But her personality, her drive, her psychopathy catches up to her, doesn't it? Before I let
yes,
you go, tell us what happens to Bessie and Rocco one fateful day much later.
Well, that was in August of 1930. The British Empire Games were on at the time in the Hamilton area, which is where their mansion was. They had been out earlier that day visiting somebody in jail, and then they went over to a friend's house to spend the evening, and I think they had dinner, played cards. When they went back to their mansion, Bessie got out of their car. They had two cars. One was parked in the garage. They had driven one, obviously, to go out that day. She opened the garage door. She went in to turn the light on in the garage. And two men stepped out behind the second car that was parked in the garage. And she was hit by two blasts of a 12-gauge shotgun, one in the face and one in the hip. It killed her instantly. She let out a scream. And that was the end of Bessie. She was no more. Rocco exited the car, ran up the street screaming in terror because he thought, you know, maybe this was intended for him, but it wasn't. Bessie was the type of person that didn't think much of abusing somebody. And I think what she failed to recognize was that although she was very clever and she thought that gave her some sort of superiority to the people that she, you know, Italian organized crime has been predominantly men for as many centuries as it's been going on. And this was a woman who wanted to be in charge. She was verbally abusive for the people that worked for them. She was very stingy when it came to money. For the life of me, I can't figure out why. They discovered close to $1 million in cash in 1926 in her bank account, and that's
wow.
Not all the money she had. I mean, as you say, Dan, they became very wealthy. They had numerous trips down to New York, Broadway, and spending sprees. And at the time she died, she was wearing $15,000 worth of jewelry. I mean, you know, back in 1930, I mean, that was quite a lot of jewelry to be wearing, you know. And she, you know, I mean, her abusiveness, and she failed to recognize that the people she was dealing with weren't going to put up with that from her. Actually, they wouldn't put up with it from anybody. That was just, you know, their ego, you know.
Yeah.
And she, you know, she, as clever as she was, she didn't understand the people. She didn't completely understand them. And it caught up to her that night, that evening when she came home, and that ended up being her fate, you know, dying on the garage floor there. And
yeah.
Rocco emotionally fell apart for about 6 or 8 months afterwards, he wouldn't leave the house. He was terrified. And then finally, I guess he got the word that, you know, why it was done and everything. And there was nothing he could do about it.
Yeah.
You know.
It's interesting, too, that there was attempts on his life afterwards. His business went to ruin because he couldn't, I don't know, he couldn't focus on it. But a couple bombs were set for him, one in his house, one in his car. And then finally he was, again, bad luck. It was Italians put in internment camps. And when he was released after 3 years, he went missing, never seen again. And then you
yeah.
write, well, that he actually lived his life out, or reportedly lived his life out, in Massena, New York. Anyway, I want to thank you so much, Joseph Lapello, for coming on and talking about your book, Murder Lost to Time, The True Story of One of Canada's Oldest Unsolved Murders. This was a fascinating investigation that you undertook. Congratulations on finding, I believe, and you believe, who killed your great-uncle and exactly why. It's a fascinating story. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about this. This book is available in ebook and paperback, and also you can be found on Facebook. Am I not correct?
That's true. Yes, it is, Dan. And once again, thank you very much for having me, and I hope your listeners have enjoyed our talk here about my book, and I hope they'll check it out.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Joseph A. Lapello. Murder Lost to Time, The True Story of One of Canada's Oldest Unsolved Murders. You have a great evening. Good night.
Thank you, Dan. Good night.
Good night.